Owlin and her two companions were soon on the boat. The woman sitting against the back rail tried to gather her strength, physical and magical once more, while Bodlon was pulled away by the lakemen, questions coming at him from every direction. A couple of others, along with Adrian and Talmadge, managed the small square sail. Apart from the conversations with Bodlon, which quickly ebbed, many arguments broke out about where they should go.
East! East!
No, to the nearest bank!
The wind is off!
We need to go northwest!
Yes!
Across the lake!
Ask her!
Talmadge pointed at Owlin, and all eyes turned her way.
What?
She didn't know the question, and didn't know what to think about any of this, still stunned by the sheer magnitude of life-changing events that had happened this day. And the sun wasn't even above the top of Firok's Spoyer yet.
You have seen the attackers. The argument across the boat is to flee fully, across the lake, or take to shore and counterattack.
Run. There are many thousands. You cannot beat them. Even the Uskar.
The arguing continued, with shouting from boat to boat in the large and growing refugee flotilla. Square sails catching the southern wind, whatever choice they might eventually make, at this point, the goal was simply to put the lizard-riding attackers far behind. Cries of terror and pain echoed across the water sporadically, most from the south, from those who had tried to hide instead of flee, no doubt. Then a larger communal shout went up somewhere along the lake's western shore.
Curse, Ilok.
No sooner had Conabra arrived at the northern edge of the winter platform to better see the mounting turmoil down the mountainside than cries rang up from both the east and the west. The witch ran about, trying to get a measure of the situation that she could report to Merrin. But she stopped dead in her tracks, her eyes going wide. For never had she seen such creatures as these riding in on lizards to meet the line of Uskar warriors. She thought them beautiful and hideous all at once, with their red and blue faces and golden skin. Mesmerized, Conabra hardly noted the swarm of spears flying at the warriors from every ridge, it seemed. And it wasn't until half the defending line went down hard, writhing and spurting blood, that she came to truly appreciate the situation. Only the coven could stop the Uskar camp from being quickly overrun. She rushed for the trees.
Where is Teyali?
Haname! Lead us!
Hearing calls for Teyali, who had not returned, and for Haname, who had taken the lead in the Uskar Triumph's absence.
To the north! You there! Take seven warriors and try to take down the lizards!
Conabra passed him near the center of the compound, barking orders, waving warriors all about. The witch had barely cleared him, though, when his calls became groans, and the stones about him clattered with falling missiles. She glanced over her shoulder to see him lying on his back, a dozen spears sticking from his body. On she ran, into the grove, pushing through branches toward Dale Uskar. The crystal obelisk flared brilliantly, its light so blinding that it stopped her where she stood among the pines. As her eyes readjusted, Conabra saw her sisters, all of them, buried to their waists in dirt.
Where's the soft grass of the beautiful Lee?
She focused on Merrin, struggling near the crystal god, reaching for the obelisk, her fingers barely touching it. The crystal flared. It seemed as if something, some humanoid, was inside.
Uskar?
She dared hope. The ground before the crystal began to churn, rolling over, and then a gigantic head rose from the ground before her, showing the distinctive markings of the invaders, the red nose and bright blue streaks. He, for it was a male form, continued to rise up, up, standing thrice the height of the tallest Uskar. He reached down with one hand, giant but slender, and cupped Marin's chin, tilting her head back so that she had to look up to him. Conabra nearly fainted.
What? How? Is this Uskar? But how could it be Uskar, looking like the strange monsters now slaughtering our tribe?
She did well to stop herself from screaming. She did better by rushing away, out of the grove, into the highest point on the plateau's northwestern edge. There, she clutched the green-flecked crystalline tip of a spear she had collected in her run, Aname's spear. She called to the song within and leaped, fast-floating, down the mountainside.
You hear my voice inside of you.
The godlike giant loomed over Marin.
Echo it. Sing.
Marin couldn't possibly refuse. She had never seen anything so beautiful as this creature in all of her life. Had never heard anything so beautiful as his voice in all her life.
This is Uskar. Come to me in my time of need.
She found the notes, the harmony of light, of beauty, of life itself. And so she sang. And the ground did roil beneath her, the churning soil lifting her up, releasing her from the earth's grasp. She stood by the crystal god and she sang. And the great giant moved to each of the sisters in turn and showed them his light, and they too sang, and they too were lifted from their earthen traps.
Dance!
The coven danced and sang. The crystal flared with power, its tip glowing as brilliantly as the sun above. Beneath the northeastern section of the grove, directly ahead of the crystal's tip, the ground began to glow angrily and smoke began to rise. One of the pines in that area flared with fire. Then others joined, a sudden and ferocious conflagration. Sap exploded and cinders flew, small fireballs launched into the air to be caught on southern winds. But the witches didn't stop. A great gust of wind came up, a hurricane to mock the blast Owlin had used to topple Marin and the others, and so aimed was it that not a branch shook on any tree that was not within the conflagration. But those burning trees, their roots incinerated, the ground beneath them more molten than solid, flew away like great flaming spears. Through that opening in the grove, the view opened wide, down to Lochbeog's eastern banks.
Sing!
The giant godlike creature bid them. And how could they not? For none of them had ever heard a sweeter music, a song promising peace and eternal joy. Gliding on the southern winds, the boat holding Owlin was more than halfway across Lochbeog as the sun neared its zenith that day. Most of the other boats of refugees moved beside them. Dozens of other boats had broken off, most going for the eastern shore, but some turning west, intending to land north of Kar Sylok. Talmadge stood with Hote, Adrian, Owlin, and Bodlon.
The Karakhan Shoal survivors are not pleased by our choice.
I should be with them. I would be, except that I'd be only a burden.
Owlin stared at the woman, awkwardly sitting, her one leg tucked under her, its girth tilting her to the side.
Look!
A call from another boat had them all turning, looking back to the south, to Firok's Spoyer. There, high on the mountain, at the winter plateau, Owlin believed, a host of trees went up in a sudden burst of angry flames.
Marin.
Owlin was wrong. Smoke billowed into the sky, and moments later, the fiery line blew out, exploding forward and scattering on the mountain winds. Owlin was standing then, staring hard.
Marin?
She couldn't tell from this distance, of course, but she feared that the fire was up by her tribe. Was, perhaps, at the sacred grove about Dale Uskar, trees she had climbed as a child. All of them, on all the boats, stood and stared. Some of the lakemen on Owlin's boat quietly cheering at the apparent demise of the Uskar. From that spot, high on the mountain, there came a bright light, brighter than the midday sun, and Owlin shielded her eyes and could not stand to look at it directly for more than a brief moment at a time. A beam of white searing light shot out from it, from that spot, down the mountainside, hitting a high outcropping and melting the stone, then bursting through on its path of obliteration. It shot through a stand of tall trees, which immediately burst into flames, then continued down the mountainside, crossing east of Facet Cran, high above the sacked village of Karakhan Shoal. A great hissing sound to the east broke the trance, and all the refugees on all the boats swiveled their heads to regard the source.
What? How?
It can't be?
What is that?
A spray of steam arose from the lake, the water superheating under the power of that strange beam of white light. Then came an explosion, huge and terrible, and a gout of molten stone leaped into the air, breaking the waves. And then a second line of fiery stone, fountaining from the rocky ground along that eastern shoreline.
By the gods, what?
Another explosion shook the whole of the plateau, and another geyser of lava leaped forth.
Sail! Row!
As with anyone who had ever looked down upon Loch Biog from the higher perches of Firoc Spoyer, Alden had often wondered what might happen if the mountains, forming the eastern banks of that huge lake, had ever broken and split. Beyond that narrow bank of mountains, the land fell away for nearly half a mile, down to the desert of black stones. Another explosion, more gouts of liquefied stone spewing into the midday sky.
What is that?
Sail! Row!
What are they doing?
I do not know.
Breaching?
Sail! Get off the lake! Get off the lake!
Many of the boats were already trying to do so. Many of those already on the way to the east fast-tacked and tried to turn about. Unseen explosions could be heard beyond the mountains. Fountains of lava reached up among the eastern mountain range. Fiery boulders flew high, some arcing out over the lake to splash down angrily. A rain of them dropped near to the bank, among the leading boats that had turned that way. Pummeling them, igniting them, sending men, women, and children leaping helplessly into the sizzling waters.
We have to go to them!
No!
Alan's reaction surprised the others.
Daemon!
The boat is drifting. All the boats are drifting. The lake! The lake!
The lake!
It is draining.
Talmadge, too, noticed the new current.
The eastern wall of the plateau has breached.
He ran to the side of the boat, grabbed one of the simple rigging lines, and leaped up on the rail.
Row hard and sail to the north or to the west!
A huge explosion shook the lake and nearly sent Talmadge overboard. Then came another answer, this time from the lake itself. As the water broke not so far away and a huge serpentine head appeared, rising up above one of the other boats, all teeth and horns and primal fury, as angry as the spews of lava, as unstoppable as a volcano. Down it crashed, splintering the boat into a thousand pieces, crushing the poor sailors or sending them flying. Alyn stood and lifted her arms, facing the sail. She called upon her moonstone and brought forth a tremendous rush of wind, and the boat leaped away, speeding to the north. The man in the silver breastplate, using his own magic, the man took the end of a rope in hand and leaped out from their boat, running across the water to tie off a second boat, the one carrying Catriona of Facet Cram.
What are you doing?
Where are you taking us?
We need to stay out here!
We go, or we die.
Given the growing catastrophe all about them, it was hard to dispute the notion. Everyone wanted to help their fellow lake dwellers. Everyone realized, to their horror, that there was nothing that could be done. Adrian came back to the rail then, looking miserable, but with Catriona's boat somewhat in tow, and now tied to their own. Adrian turned grimly to Alyn and nodded.
Bring the wind.
Alyn brought forth the power of her moonstone, the sails bending, the boat racing away to the north. As they passed other craft, Alyn looked to the man at the rudder.
Move near!
She offered as much wind as she could to the other boats as well, though the focus remained on her own. Soon they were far in the lead, speeding toward the northern shore. To the east, the explosions and gouts of lava continued. Out of sight, along the sheer mountain wall dropping to the desert far below, huge boulders shifted and blew out, the pressure of the lake sending great waterfalls spraying forth. Far behind, boats were swept away on the rolling tide. The great monster of the loch came forth again and took a second boat, then a third. Up atop Firoc Spoyer, the beam continued, reaching down to eat at the eastern wall, to crack the mountain bowl that held Loch Biog. Alyn collapsed with exhaustion when her boat at last slid ashore the northern beach, a shoreline that was noticeably lower than it had been earlier that same afternoon. She let Bodlon help her out of the boat and fell down on the wet sands, her magic gone. The second boat, towed by the line Adrian had given them, came in right after, but the next in line was still far away, oars splashing, sails trying to catch those southern winds. Alyn watched the strange man in the silver breastplate run out from the beach, rope in hand.
He's a good man. He'll try to help.
Alyn wanted to as well, but she had no strength left. She doubted she could stand on her own at that time, and the song of her magical gemstones was naught but a distant buzz, inaccessible. When the sun went down and twilight fell, the beam continued, and bright lava leaped high, and the crackles of explosions intertwined with the continual thunderous roar of gigantic waterfalls. And the waters of Loch Biog lowered, waterfalls raining on the desert far below, sweeping boats and refugees away to the east. She had only two magics in the spear tip she held, the green flecks of malachite to lighten her step or allow her to float down the mountain, and the small bits of diamond that allowed her to brighten or darken the area around her. Conabra used the second of those magical powers most of all now, down off the mountain and along the western bank of the fast-diminishing Loch Biog. Surrounded by enemies, human and non-human alike, the terrified witch crouched in the shadows and enhanced those shadows around her. She didn't know where she could possibly go, so she kept moving away from the mountain. Her people were all dead, she believed. How could any of them have survived the hordes of attacks and that giant, godlike creature she had seen rising from the ground of the Sacred Lee?
What can I do? Where can I go?
She had passed by a town of lakemen only moments before a horde of those painted-faced humanoids had sacked it. So many had fled, the same way Conabra had been running. Over and over again, she heard the screams as the invaders caught them and cut them down. The sun was setting now before her. Terribly afraid, Conabra found a cubby under the exposed roots of a leaning willow tree, and there she huddled. She closed her eyes tight and kept them shut, but she did not sleep. She could not sleep because the night was full of screams and thunderous explosions and earthquakes that shook the ground about her so violently that she feared the tree under which she huddled would topple over at any moment. She didn't know what to do. Aulin awakened the next morning to find herself alone in the shallow cave she had shared with Bodlon and some others. She came out bleary-eyed, still exhausted from the events of the previous day. Still, hers had not been a solid sleep, for the ground had shaken and rolled so many times, as if entire mountains had fallen. She walked out and looked about the lower trails to the north and west, but saw little activity, though she did note that many of the huge stones of this boulder-strewn region seemed as if they had moved in the earthquakes. She couldn't be certain, because she did not really know this area, and had only glimpsed it in the twilight briefly, and while exhausted. Still, it looked different to her. Everything looked different to Aulin. Making her way around the rock that formed this shelter, she found her companions, many of them standing along the higher ridge up above, all looking back toward Loch Biog. Aulin crawled up the slope, noting Bodlon, Talmadge, the man in the breastplate, Adrian, and the crippled, dark-skinned woman named Hote. When she got up beside them, she had no voice with which to greet them. For there, before her, Loch Biog was gone, and in its stead lay a vast and huge valley. To the east, a large section of the mountains had indeed fallen away, leaving a wide opening, and just below the lower edge of a massive crack in the bowl of the Ayamaras Plateau, as far as Aulin could see, the desert of black stones was no more, replaced by a seemingly endless lake. She turned her attention to the uncovered valley, and it seemed strange to her, unnatural, as if some giant hands and not simple nature had shaped it. She noted worked stones all along its steep sides.
Steps? Structures built among the dark holes? Those appear to be caves?
Her gaze traveled to the valley floor, half a mile below, and to a large mound, it seemed, down there in the center. No, not just a mound, she realized, but a strange, four-sided, mountain-like structure, too constant and homogeneous, its sides symmetrical.
It's a pyramid.
Aulin stared at him blankly. Adrian stepped over and held something out to her. As soon as she took the item, a lens, she felt its magic. She brought it to her eyes and called upon the song, and the mountain at the bottom of the valley came clear to her. The sides were all stepped, evenly and beautifully, though mounds of silt covered many of the stairs. She moved her gaze about, seeing thousands of structures, and came to understand that she was looking down upon what once had been a massive settlement, a village 1,000 times larger than all the Lakemen villages and the Uskar encampments combined. It lay in disrepair, of course, with mounds of mud, vast puddles, even small ponds of water and fields of dead fish all about. But it was there, without doubt, a city, once a glorious and massive settlement.
How could this be?
Aulin's magically enhanced gaze roamed far to the south wall, to the stairs there, carved along the wall, climbing out of the veil to the shadows of Firox Boyer. She saw the invaders swarming like hungry ants, working their way down those stairs, cleaning them, reclaiming them. Aulin brought the lens down from her eyes and stared open-mouthed at Talmadge and the others, completely at a loss.
"'Tis not possible."
None of them had an answer. On a sudden impulse, the young woman brought the lens back up to her eyes and gazed far across to Firox Boyer to see what had become of her people. From a still distant vantage, she found the sacred grove and saw that a part of it had been blown out, as she had suspected the previous day. She started to magnify that image, wanting to peer inside, and she did see a shining point that she believed to be the obelisk of the crystal god. But then dropped the lens and fell away in shock and fear. Adrian gathered up the lens and took her place, quickly looking back to the mountain.
Ugh.
He too backpedaled and waved for all the others to get down. They all understood a few heartbeats later when a gigantic snake came into view, swimming in the air the way a normal snake might have swum the waters of Loch Biak. No, not a snake, they realized as it came closer. For this creature had a more lizard-like head and jaw and great horns, and behind that head, perhaps a quarter of the way down its serpentine body, were small wings and nothing that should have held it aloft.
The lake monster.
The lake monster?
Surely not.
A great and horrifying beast.
For as the lake monster moved down below them, into the vast mountain valley before them, they saw that it had a rider, one who looked very much like the invaders who had come against them. Except that this one was huge, a true giant, large enough to ride a serpent that seemed 100 strides long and as wide as a house.
"'Tis not possible! 'Tis not possible! 'Tis not possible!"
Aulin's sentiment was echoed all throughout the 100 refugees who had managed to get to this northern bank, 100 survivors who had left 30 times their number behind. Everything looked different to Aulin. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Tales of the Coven, Book 2, Reckoning of Fallen Gods, by R.A. Salvatore. Narrated by Eric Messner. Directed and adapted for graphic audio by Eric Messner. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nicole Shera and Kobe Jameson. Featuring Katie Booth as Aulin, Ruthie Bowles as Twolinottle, Delton Angle Sorrell as Adrian, Danny Montoot as Tay Alig, Joey Sorlis as Talmadge, Julian Daly as Scoth Mizane, Morgan Dalabetta as Conabra, Rob Morera as Atakisht, Stephanie Namet Parker as Marin, Tyler Herchuk as Bodlon, Adrian Garcia as the Old Augur, Drew Copas as Asba, Karenna Foley as Tamily, Kimberly Cochran as Hote, Nicole Perez as Catriona, and Patrick Boylan as Ogmore. Also with Rainer Gabriel, Sarah Greenfield, Stuart Crank, Yasmin Twazon, Yenny Ann, Andrew James Spooner, Anthony Palmini, Nora Ashradi, Laura C. Harris, Eric Messner, Bianca Bryan, Daniel Yaka, Elena Anderson, Aaron Lynn, Joe Mallon, Jonathan Church, Jonathan Sleep, Michael John Casey, Kelly Baskin, Mike Carnes, Mike Siporkin, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, Torian Brackett, and Rob McFadgen. Produced by Colleen Delaney, Scott McCormick, David Zitney, Casey Green, and Aaron Coe. Executive producers Angie Cornett, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Copyright 2019, R.A. Salvatore. All rights reserved. Recorded with the permission of the author. Copyright 2026, Graphic Audio, LLC, all rights reserved. Published by arrangement with R.A. Salvatore, all rights reserved. Sound recording copyright 2026 by Graphic Audio, LLC, all rights reserved. Graphic Audio is an RB Media audio brand. This recording is protected by copyright. Unauthorized copying, sharing, or distribution is prohibited. Thank you. Keep listening to hear samples from Tad Williams' Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn and Zodiac Academy by Caroline Peckham and Suzanne Valenti, now available in Graphic Audio. Find these titles along with audiobook giveaways, discounts, new releases, recommendations, and more at graphicaudio.net.
Lucky for you, it was not your sword-wielding hand that was lost.
Lucky indeed.
Joshua measured himself a pace and a half, then turned to face Elias.
On the other hand... that was a poor choice of words, wasn't it? My apologies. Alternately, it is unlucky that we must fence with these poor wooden oars.
He waggled the practice sword.
I do so enjoy watching you use... what do you call that thin blade of yours? Nidal. It is a pity you do not have it here.
Without warning, Elias leaped forward, swinging a hard backhand toward Joshua's head. The prince caught the blow, allowing it to slide by, then thrust forward. Elias trapped the oncoming lunge and deftly turned it aside. The two brothers backed apart, circling. Joshua leveled his sword before him, his thin face slick with sweat.
Yes. It is too bad that Nidal is not with me. It is also too bad that you do not have Brightnail.
The prince made a swift downward cut and slid into another looping thrust. The king backpedaled swiftly, then counterattacked.
Brightnail? What do you mean by that? You know that it is buried with our father.
He ducked an arching backhand and pushed Joshua back.
Oh, I know. But a king's sword, just like his kingdom, should be wisely and proudly... should be wisely and carefully used by his heir.
The two wooden blades slid together, hilts locked. Elias and Joshua's faces were merely inches apart, muscles bunched beneath the brothers' shirts. For a moment, they were nearly still. The only movement, a slight trembling as they strained against each other. Finally, Joshua, who could not grip his hilt with two hands as the king could, felt his blade begin to slide. With a supple shrug, he disengaged and sprang backward, lowering the blade before him again. As they faced each other across the expanse of grass, chests heaving, the bells of Green Angel Tower marked the noontide.
There you are, gentlemen.
Isgrimner stepped in, a sickly smile on his face. There had been no mistaking the naked hatred that flowed between the two.
He prowled towards me, with purpose in his gaze. I glanced at the dizzying drop of doom beside me and shifted further from it.
Yeah. It's great, thanks. But I really should be getting back to my lesson.
Don't you want a closer look?
He closed the distance between us once more.
I can see it just fine from here.
Like the view, little Vega?
I looked between the two heirs for any hint that they might be about to back off, but the excitement which danced between them gave me my answer.
I think she needs a closer look.
Yeah. Can't really appreciate it from way back here.
Holy shit on a starfish. My mind whirled with some way out of this, but before I could think of a single thing, Caleb shot towards me, shoving my chest so that I was thrown towards the edge. I fell backwards, a scream escaping me as the sea of razor-sharp rocks winked at me with promises of death.
Two hands caught mine before I could tumble to my doom, and my heart leapt as my sneakers scrambled for purchase on the crumbling lip of the ledge. I hung at their mercy, my back to the terrifying drop below.
Pull me up! Pull me up!
They grinned at me with twin smiles of beautiful devils, and I clung to their hands with all of my strength as they held me in limbo.
Solaria has been much better off since the Vegas left the throne to the celestial families. Since our parents took up the throne that yours left cold, our world has been a better place. We don't need you to come back here and claim it for yourselves. We don't want you to.
We didn't ask for this. We don't want it. You can keep your stupid throne and your power.
That's a beautiful offer, sweetheart. But it doesn't change the facts. Your blood right means the throne belongs to you. So long as you prove yourself capable of taking it. And there are enough people who would support your claim to cause a civil war over it.
We don't want it. How can you seriously expect us to rule over a nation we know nothing about? It's insane!
It could have been the dim light in the chamber, but for a moment, I could have sworn that Caleb's features softened a little.
Look, all we want is to learn how to control this magic inside us and get our inheritance. That's it! We grew up with no one and nothing! Before we came here, we weren't even sure if we were going to be able to keep a roof over our heads for the winter. I swear! We have zero interest in claiming any throne or taking your places.
Nah. I say we drop her.
My grip on them tightened with panic, and my magic swirled like a tempest within me. But if I wanted to attempt to use it, I was going to have to release my grip to free my hands, and there was no way in hell I was taking that risk. I began to wonder if they might truly let me fall. No one had seen them take me down here. They could leave and pretend they'd never seen me. Let someone else discover my body dashed to pieces on the rocks below. But I wasn't going to let them rule my fate like that. If there was even the slightest chance that I could get myself out of this, then I was going to do it.
Thanks for listening to this Graphic Audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,700 titles to choose from. Listen to over 225 binge-worthy series. We feature titles and genres like science fiction, fantasy, romanticy, westerns, mystery thrillers, comics, and more. Check out our exclusive series such as Deathlands, Rogue Angel, Outlanders, Tangent Knights, and Agent of Exiles, which are only available in our dramatized adaptation format. Experience a radically different type of audiobook produced with a full cast, sound effects, and cinematic music. Listen to a movie in your mind. On the go, anytime, anywhere. Our dramatized adaptation titles are available at all major audiobook retailers and platforms. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and other social platforms. For more information and samples of all our titles, visit our website at graphicaudio.net.